Hi, this is Father Gordon.
Yes.
Hi, I was wondering, are you aware that Benedict XVI rejects Vatican Council I? He does so because he teaches that the Eastern, quote, Orthodox are inside the Church of Christ, even though they reject the papacy.
Okay. Well, could I ask who this is?
My name is Brother Peter.
Brother Peter, okay. And where are you from, Brother?
I'm from New York. Are you familiar with his position in that regard?
I'm not.
Like, I'm sure you're familiar with the Eastern, quote, Orthodox, who reject the papacy.
Eastern Orthodox
who
reject the papacy.
Yeah, this...
Yes.
Yeah, they deny Vatican I, and they don't believe in the papal primacy, and so they're heretics and schismatics, according to Catholic teaching. And in the ecumenical documents he's put out, and actually the official teaching of his church, they consider the bishops and the churches in communion with the Eastern, quote, Orthodox bodies to be inside the Church of Christ. And he's said this in his book. It's taught in Vatican II. It's taught in Dominus Jesus. And that's actually heretical.
Well, yeah, I know. We know anything that's, contradictory to the teachings of the Church is absolutely that, you know. I'd have to look at that myself. I mean, I know, I'd have to look at that myself. I couldn't make a...
Well, I could email it to you, some of the quotes. He also teaches that Protestantism is not even heresy.
No, it is.
Yeah, and were you aware that he went into synagogues and took part in Jewish worship?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Do you agree that he's a heretic?
I can't say for sure he's a heretic. I would have to, I can't say that. I can't say he's a heretic. The thing is, first of all, I have to look at him as the papacy. We're always going to have a visible head of the church. That's always the teaching of the church. You always have to have that visible head. And there's going to be problems, in the church. There's going to be problems. You know, even with the papacy, you can go to Alexander VI, look at his life and things like that. But I don't think the Pope can be stated to be a formal heretic according to the teachings of the Church.
Well,
that would be my...
There have been situations in Church history where we have not had a Pope. Like every time a Pope dies, the chair is vacant. And there have been extended interregna in Church history. And the Church teaches that when you're confronted with a man who's a manifest heretic who claims to be the Pope, that he actually cannot be considered the Pope. He would lose his office automatically. And that's the teaching of the doctors of the Church who have addressed the issue, such as St. Robert Bellarmine, St. Francis de Sales, St. Alphonsus. And so according to the proper application of Catholic teaching, he would definitely not be a Pope. And we know... Go ahead.
Right. But who would be able to make that judgment? We need an infallible head to give us that judgment.
You wouldn't, and no one could make it because no one could make an infallible judgment on someone who actually is the Pope. Catholics can recognize someone who is not the Pope, certainly to be outside the Church and not the Pope, in the same way that you recognize a pro-abortion politician who claims to be Catholic as outside the Church. Like, do you regard Nancy Pelosi as a Catholic?
Absolutely not.
By what authority do you consider her outside the Church? She's never been declared.
Right, but the very fact that she's contrary to church teaching, she's got the explicit, she's made the explicit things, and plus the very fact that you've had, our local archbishop, has spoken of, on similar grounds with the former governor out here in Kansas, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she's now in the
Kathleen Sebelius?
Yes. So he explicitly stated she was excommunicated and she couldn't receive communion.
Well, but for example, Ted Kennedy, you're familiar with him. He died. He was commemorated as a servant of Christ.
He's commemorated as a servant of Christ.
Yeah, after his death, they held a quote funeral for him. They gave him quote communion throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And Nancy Pelosi's never been excommunicated. And so the point is that you take it upon yourself, and you're correct when you do so, to acknowledge her as outside the Church by virtue of the fact that she's departed from Catholic teaching. The same principle applies to priests and bishops and even a man who claims to be the Pope. Benedict XVI is more heretical than Pelosi.
Well, I would say, well, the other thing too on Nancy Pelosi, if she were to say, let's say if she wasn't married or whatever, and she were to come to me to receive the sacrament of matrimony, she would be considered still under canon law, and she would be still considered a Catholic in that regard. In which case, you know, she would have to, you know, she would be understood to be a baptized Catholic, you know, and unless she explicitly rejected the faith in that case or publicly excommunicated. Now, we can say her practice, she's definitely not a practicing Catholic. That's absolute, you know. And then to say, well, she's no longer Catholic. What makes her forfeit the right of being Catholic? Yeah, you'd have to be, you know, and then she'd have to be obviously declared in that position. But I guess getting back to the point on the Pope himself, somebody has to be ahead. Now, I know that in the interim, there's obviously, yes, there's going to be a vacant seat, and that's very obvious, you know. But when we have a Pope, though, there's no vacant seat.
Well, but what you're saying under canon law, she would be considered a Catholic. Actually, she wouldn't, because all heretics and schismatics in canon law are ipso facto excommunicated. And Pope Leo XIII, enshrining the traditional principle of the Church in his encyclical Satis Cognitum, said that the practice of the Church has always been the same, that when someone departs from the authoritative rule of the magisterium, that person is considered alien to the Church. And it's just like if someone came to you and tried to convert and said, I'm going to become a Catholic, I accept all of Catholic teaching, but I don't accept the Council of Trent's teaching on justification. I don't think you'd tell him that he could become a member of the Catholic Church. Doing so.
But if you were operating outside the magisterium of the Church, then would you be considered excommunicated?
If someone departs from the teaching of the magisterium, someone would be considered excommunicated. I'm not departing from the teaching of the magisterium. The teaching of the magisterium requires me to reject someone like Benedict XVI as a heretic. And here's another point, that if he's the Pope, the Catholic Church officially teaches that non-Catholics may receive communion. Do you accept that?
Officially teaches? I don't see where he says officially.
It's taught in Vatican II, Orientalium Ecclesiarum number 27. It's taught in the New Catechism. It's taught in the New Code of Canon Law.
Well, we know the Second Vatican Council is not a doctrinal council, so there's no doctrine being taught in it. And that's even Pope John the 23rd would go so far because he didn't instigate it on that purpose. And even Pope Paul VI said there's no doctrine being taught in this. And so it's obviously it's not a doctrine. I think that's where a lot of the major confusion is. It's this pastoral council which caused the problems and the confusion in the Church. There's no doctrine being...
Well, that's not correct. John the 23rd actually never said it was a pastoral council. He said that it would reflect the magisterium.
But if you've read Walter Abbott's version of the... which was the earliest version of the Second Vatican II documents... He writes that in his introduction in that, which was, and Walter Abbott was very proud of putting that one out because he was the first one to put it on the market, and it clearly shows that the imprudence at the time that the Church caused as a result of that, because you see all these Protestant, commentaries on there, and they clearly show the misunderstanding of what's going on, you know, and so the Church has been put in confusion. I'm not going to say that it's doctrinal because it's not doctrinal.
Well, let me just give you a quote in that regard that you said it doesn't deal with doctrine. Paul VI, in his encyclical Ecclesiam Suum, he said that the Second Vatican Council has the task of dealing once more with the doctrine of the Church and of defining it. And actually, at the end of every document, there is solemn language attached to it in which Paul VI, who confirmed the council, approved, decreed, and established everything by his so-called apostolic authority in the Holy Spirit. And we have maybe 15 or 20 quotes from these post-Vatican II quote popes, which declare that Vatican II is binding, Vatican II is magisterial, you cannot be part of the Church unless you accept it. Go ahead.
I've never seen that. It's not binding. I mean, where would it say? I mean, it's imprudent, I'd say, but it's not binding. I mean, it never says in there that I have to say the new mass.
Well, actually, Paul VI did give a speech in which he pointed out that the new mass was the official promulgated liturgy of the Church. But what I'm talking about right now would be what was promulgated at Vatican II. And in fact, in his closing speech at the council, Paul VI said, "We decide, moreover, that all that has been established synodally is to be religiously observed by all of the faithful. All the constitutions, decrees, declarations, and votes have been approved and promulgated, and he declared this in virtue of his apostolic authority. And as I was saying, at the end of every document, this is also in the Abbott version, you will find this, each and every one of the things set forth in this decree has won the consent of the fathers. We too, by the apostolic authority conferred on us by Christ, join with the venerable fathers in approving, decreeing, and establishing these things in the Holy Spirit, and we direct that what has thus been enacted in synod be published to God's glory. I, Paul, Bishop of the Catholic Church. That's more formal than you have. Go ahead.
Yeah, but it wasn't, he doesn't declare them defined. I mean, the language has to be very, very precise, and it's very clear that the language, in fact, that's what we learned in seminary. The language is not precise enough to say that this is not defined. I mean, yes, they're defining, they're falling back on this and this, but which means that they are relying upon the Church Fathers, and when there's a contradiction between them and the Church Fathers, obviously the Church Fathers and tradition have to take precedence over it.
Well, the language actually is solemn. The language, in fact, I've compared it to the past bulls of, for example, the Council of Florence or Vatican I. The language is similar. And here's just one quote from Ratzinger on Vatican II. He says, "It is likewise impossible to decide in favor of Trent and Vatican I, but against Vatican II. Whoever denies Vatican II denies the authority that upholds the other two councils." And that's why in the discussions with the Society of St. Pius X, one of the conditions for their, quote, incorporation into full communion is their acceptance of the, quote, Magisterium of Vatican II. And so it's undeniable, and I could give you all kinds of, here's actually from one of the notes that was published in the Vatican's newspaper, a full recognition of the Second Vatican Council and the Magisterium of John XXIII, Paul VI, etc., is an indispensable condition for any future recognition of the Society of St. Pius X. And just quote after quote after quote from these guys you would recognize as popes saying that you cannot reject the council. Like, you obviously would accept the Council of Nicaea.
No, of course.
Well, we don't have anything directly from the pope who promulgated that council, Pope St. Sylvester, in which he confirmed the dogmatic definition of Nicaea. Why do we accept that as dogmatic, or why was it accepted as dogmatic at that time?
Well, because he was their president at the thing. But the thing is, I'd have to go, and quite honestly, I'd really have to go through and look at this right now and do my homework, because you're kind of catching me off.
Well, the answer is that his legates approved it. His representatives signed it. And so that signature...
Right, I'd have to look at it myself, because I always want to have more.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. That's a fact that there's no solemn papal bull from Sylvester promulgating or confirming the dogmatic definition of Nicaea. But because a dogmatic definition or a doctrinal definition was drawn up, and it bore a universal character already because the bishops from all over the world were called, and he simply confirmed it because his legates signed it, that was enough. And so my point is that what we have from these guys confirming Vatican II far exceeds what we have from popes who confirmed numerous councils in the past. And yet there was no question about the dogmatic status of their decrees on faith. So the point is that if these guys are popes, if Paul VI was a pope, if Benedict XVI is a pope, which he's not, but if he is, the Vatican II's decree, for example, on non-Christian religions would be binding. Vatican II's teaching on religious liberty, where it says that religious liberty is the right of a human person enshrined in nature, okay? That is, go ahead.
No. But the thing that I would be saying is that, you know, what gives you the right to say that those are the right? Those supersede what's always been taught in the church at all times and all places. The same thing that Mary's has always said.
Oh, I believe Vatican II is filled with heresies. I reject Vatican II. I'm just pointing out that someone cannot hold the Society of St. Pius X position or the position I think that you sort of are inclined to believe that there are doctrinal problems with Vatican II, but it doesn't really affect the magisterium because Paul VI didn't make it binding. It doesn't hold up. It's actually a myth that Vatican II is somehow different in that regard. No, there's plenty of evidence that he promulgated it authoritatively. And in fact, Benedict XVI, in his third most recent book, Light of the World, he's talking about this issue we were discussing earlier about the true particular churches issue. And he says, and not even a pope can offer an alternative definition of a church. No, he has no authority over that. The Second Vatican Council is binding on him. And so he clearly believes that what the Second Vatican Council said about the church, about the sister churches, quote, of the Orthodox, true particular churches, is binding.
Yeah, but the thing, I guess my point would be, see, here's where I'd have a qualms, and I would fall back here on my personal conscience, you know, that okay, this being the case, so I guess the point you're trying to make to me is that we have no pope and the see is vacant. And, I mean, obviously the society position is completely untenable, because if you're going to go that direction, you have to be Seder Kantis.
Right.
Because it's completely untenable in their position. And right now, the practical Seder Kantis, they say that there's a pope. However, in practice, they're not practicing as if there is. That position is very clear to me. I realize there's serious confusion in the church. And the one thing that's got me hinged is Ubi Petrus Ibi Ecclesia. You know, that's the one thing, you know, and granted, the clearest judgments that I can make is to teach always what the Church has always taught, and I don't teach anything contrary.
Well, you say Ubi Petrus Ibi Ecclesia, where purity is, there is the Church.
That's
the point, that in accepting Benedict XVI, you can't believe that, because he teaches that where Peter is not, there is the Church.
The thing is, was he validly elected pope?
No, he wasn't. Because according...
Why not? Why was he not?
Because the teaching of the Catholic Church is, and Pope Paul IV made this explicit in his bull Cum Ex Apostolatus Officio, that a heretic cannot be validly elected pope. And Benedict XVI taught dozens of major heresies prior to his election.
Right. But the thing is that... The infallibility doesn't protect him before election. The infallibility protects him after.
But that's irrelevant, because we're not talking about infallibility. We're talking about whether a heretic can be elected validly.
But the thing that we've got to understand also is that everybody, we got to face it, is at least a material heretic. You know, there's one point where we've come up wrong in our teachings. You know, so if that's ever the case, then the only way you get to prove anybody's a heretic is materially. Then that's why the church has always given people the opportunity to formally denounce their material heresy, so that they clearly understand where the person stands formally. And I know you're familiar with the terms formal and material.
Yes.
But the thing is that was there ever an opportunity for him to deny that, if that's what we're saying? And the second, as I can clearly say that I have been a material heretic, I know from the pulpit, because I was corrected twice on sermons, and it was when I was corrected I realized that, you're absolutely right, I just shouldn't have said it. And it was the way I nuanced it. Of course, it's always going to be issues on the Trinity and things like that where it's very easy to fall into heresy, but, you know, those things being said, in that case, I could never be elected pope, not that I'd ever want to.
Well, that's not, because a material heretic is actually not a heretic. In the dogmatic teaching of the Church,
right,
they're either Catholics or heretics, and so the material heretic would be a Catholic. Benedict XVI, it's not possible for him to be a material heretic for a number of reasons. Number one, he knows about the teachings he denies. He quotes them and denies them. Mm-hmm. Number two, you can't be a material heretic on the core mysteries of faith, such as basic belief in the Trinity, that there's only one true God, that Christ is the only truth. You can't be erring in good faith about that. He teaches that we should esteem all religions. We have about 20 quotes on that. He teaches that Islam should be esteemed. He teaches that other non-Christian religions are worthy of esteem. That is apostasy. It's not. It's like someone who...
He doesn't say that they're one true church. I mean, granted, the language is very, very clearly... I would say ambiguous in the most generous terms, but I would say in the most concrete terms, it's very, very,
It's unambiguous, actually. Like,
but I mean, in that, you know, because you could say, well, we're esteemed in what sense? You know, I'd have to figure, well, what sense does he mean esteemed? I don't know.
No, he esteems their religion. Okay.
Right. But if they were to say, yeah, that he was, if he were to say they were a true religion, then you've clearly got a statement right there of heresy. You know, and so esteemed. I mean, you know what's going on in the church. I mean, there's politically correctness and things like that. They're putting statements down and everything like that to try to make these other religions seem as if they're good. However, not coming out explicitly, and that's the problem in the church, is they're confusing everybody by not putting down explicit. Well, tell me, are you telling me that they're a religion, or are you telling me that they're not, that they're the one true religion or not? I mean, you know, that's the one thing. And they're playing a political game rather than they're playing a...
Well, he teaches that they can be saved in their religions. He teaches that they're pagan saints. He teaches that Protestant religions are a means of salvation. He teaches that he agreed with the Lutherans on justification. You probably heard about the joint declaration with the Lutherans, right?
Yeah, I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, that teaches that the Council of Trent's canons no longer apply. That's manifest heresy. There's nothing unambiguous. There's nothing ambiguous about that. It's unambiguous heresy. And it actually teaches justification by faith alone. It not only teaches that it's not a heresy, but it teaches that that's the true doctrine in the annex to the official common statement. And so he's a manifest heretic in like 50 different ways, more than that. And in fact, in his most recent book, Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week, he says that the words of Matthew's gospel, his blood be upon us and our children, where it said, he says that's not historically accurate.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely historically.
You would agree that's heresy.
Right. So what's the point? I guess I've got to follow you now.
What I'm saying to you is a consistent Catholic, someone who embraces the teaching of the Church, would have to come to the conclusion that he's not a pope. And that's proven, and we actually have a website, VaticanCatholic.com. I direct you to that, and it has the documentation. And I'm really glad that you talked to me a little bit about these issues. But it's just, when he's, also getting back to when he esteems the other religions, a Catholic can't esteem a false religion. That's just heresy.
Absolutely. I mean, we can't look on it as a religion, period. But the fact of the matter is, though, is that, you know, my conclusion, I mean, I definitely have to look up what you're saying, but at the same time, it's, you know, well, then who do we follow? In other words, the gates of hell have prevailed.
That's not true. It's actually the opposite. Your position, if he is, good.
Where is the Church going then?
The Church resides in the remnant of true Catholics who hold the true positions. They're all over the world. They're all over the world. All the people who hold all the teachings of the Church and reject heresy.
It's just that. So then, it's just a church of believers, not a teaching magisterial church anymore.
No, it is, because the Church teaches even when the chair of Peter is vacant. It's just like during the Arian crisis, when most of the bishops became apostates. Did the Church still continue to exist and operate in those sees?
Because the Pope was never an apostate.
No, but there were vacancies even during those periods of time. There was no Pope. And let's say you were in a diocese where the bishop was an Arian.
Right, but there is a Pope here. I mean, there's been an elected Pope. You know?
Who?
We can say, well, we're making a conclusion that there is. You know, you're making a conclusion that there is a Pope. But, you know, what I can see is it's been validly, you know, the Pope's been validly elected.
But here's the thing, if he's the Pope, he's not only a heretic, but you have to believe that the Orthodox are part of the Church. He himself, your quote Pope, has said that's the binding teaching. That's what I just quoted for you. In his book, Light of the World, he says that...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, if you read that book, though, too, I think it's in the introduction of that book, he's not writing as a pope. I mean, he's writing as a private individual. This is one of the problems with him and Pope John Paul II, is they wrote books as private individuals. And there was even Pope Clement the 12th, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. I believe it was Clement the 12th, who had spoken about how the blessed, when they die, they don't have the vision of God.
John the 22nd.
John the 22nd, correct, yeah. Correct. Yeah, and that they don't have the vision of God. However, you know, he did retract it before he died.
Well, but see,
he wrote that as a private individual, but not as a... He didn't write that in the statement as the Pope.
That doesn't work, because that wasn't dogmatically defined until the next Pope. Pope Benedict.
But the thing is that a pope can't state something that's incorrect, though.
No, but it wasn't dogmatically defined yet. He can't state something that's incorrect. He can't deny a dogma obstinately.
Right, but the thing is that he can't. But he can't lead when it comes to faith and morals, like you yourself are saying. That if when it comes to faith and morals, he is infallible, and so he can't make a statement based on faith and morals and be fallible.
Well, he can do it as long as he's not invoking his infallible authority. As long as he's not fulfilling the criteria to teach infallibly.
Point, and that's my point with Benedict the 16th, is he's not fulfilling the criteria on this.
Vatican II did.
In the light of the world, no, in the light of the world that you're quoting on, it's saying that this is what he's saying, but he's not.
Well,
here's
the point. There are two issues. One doesn't even concern infallibility, the fact that he's not a member of the church, he's a heretic, and therefore can't be the head of the church.
Right, but the line that you're quoting, though, that document is very, very important. If you're going to quote it, and you're saying that he's a heretic, you have to show also in that statement that he is invoking infallibility.
Well, yeah, but the light of the world issue is supplementary evidence that he has taught this, quote, infallibly, or your church has, and that is proven, well, number one, by Vatican II, because the same doctrine is taught in Vatican II.
Well, and where's your church, then, if you say this is my church?
The Catholic Church exists in the remnant of true Catholics who hold the faith.
Very good, just like the Protestants. The Protestants.
No, actually,
an individual church.
You have...
Even a church of believers, not a church of magisterial people.
Sir, Benedict XVI and your church deny the visibility of the church. Vatican II says we long for the one visible church. If he's the Pope and your position is true, there is no visible church.
There is a visible church. I mean, the thing is that whether he's saying that or not, I see a visible church. I go to Rome, I see there's a chair there, there's a Pope. I mean, the very fact that you're mentioning Benedict XVI, although you don't acknowledge him as Pope, you're very clear to say that he's the one in that position right now.
You have a visible guy who denies the papacy. So as long as he dresses up in robes, even if he denies the gospel, teaches Jews can be saved, teaches the Orthodox are in the church, denies the papacy, teaches non-Catholics to receive communion, that's all that matters. And see, that's...
He didn't teach non-Catholics to receive communion. In fact, he was the one that was calling the bishops together. In fact, he's called a lot of these bishops here in America on the line because of the very fact that they're giving communion to a lot of these parole boards. You know, and so...
No, he actually said that in his decree that it's up to each person. And so he.
The thing is, he is giving that at least, you know, at least the freedom. He won't give them. He won't give communion to.
But would you agree that it is the teaching of your church that non-Catholics may lawfully receive Holy Communion?
Nope, absolutely not.
Can I?
It's never been the teaching of the Catholic Church.
No, it's the teaching of the.
You have to understand what the faith has always been. As we.
No, it's not. It's the teaching of the Vatican II Church.
Well, I'm in the church, and it's post Vatican II in the timeline, obviously. But the thing is that I hold to what's always been taught in the church. I will deny communion. I've denied communion to people before.
But like,
I have no problem with it.
Well, here's the thing: are you aware that it's taught in the new Code of Canon Law, in the new Catechism, in Vatican II, and in encyclical documents that non-Catholics may receive Holy Communion?
Well, first of all, the catechism itself is not binding.
Actually, he did say it was binding.
Where in canon law would that say? Would it say that we are to give communion?
It's stated in canon 844.4 and canon 844.3. Canon 844.3 says Catholic ministers. What's that?
Communicatio in sacris.
Catholic ministers may licitly administer the sacraments of penance, Eucharist, and anointing of the sick to members of the Oriental churches which do not have full communion with the Catholic Church. It's also taught in Vatican II. So you would be equivalent to the Society of St. Pius X in your position, that you claim he's the Pope, but yet you dissent from his official teaching.
Well, the thing is, it says it may.
He's saying that it's...
I'm not giving communion to anybody.
But...
And I can stand on that position and not be held accountable.
But he's teaching that it is permissible for Catholic ministers to give communion to non-Catholics. Mm-hmm. And that is heretical. Mm-hmm. And if he's the Pope, that's the official teaching of your church, mm-hmm. which proves that it's false.
Mm-hmm. I know that's false. I mean, but the thing is, he may, I'm not giving communion to anybody.
That's not the point.
And, the thing is, though, is this the official teaching or not? I mean, if you look at, you know, what Pope... it's very clear, though. I mean, if you're not going to give communion to, you know, to people who are in heresy... I mean, for me, it's very clear where the papacy is. That's why I am where I am. I'm not outside the... Our position with the society is not the same. Obviously, it would be the same order if we were, because our priests came from there. But the one thing is, for me, and it's always been clear for me, and in conscience, I can never violate this, is where the Pope is, that's where the Church is. And I'm not gonna go against...
Your position denies that. Here's why. Because he teaches that where the Pope is not, the Church is. He teaches that the Orthodox who reject the Pope are in the Church. And so by acknowledging him, you are actually saying that where the Pope is not, where people reject the Pope, the Orthodox, there is the Church.
And that's, but you're rejecting the Pope.
No, I'm not. I'm rejecting...
So I guess by that same statement, you're part of the Church, because you reject the Pope, too.
I reject an anti-Pope. I don't reject any Pope.
Well, there you go. But the thing is, you're in the same camp, though. So you're in the same position as the Orthodox yourself.
No, I'm not.
By that very statement. Because if you reject the Pope and everybody else rejects the Pope and the Pope considers them as part of the Church, then you're part of the Church, too, in the same freedom that you're getting.
No, the Orthodox reject all the true popes in history, their full authority and their magisterial infallibility. I don't.
You reject this one.
I reject these anti-popes who teach. He teaches that the Protestants don't even need conversion.
Right. Well, but what's the difference, though, then, between rejecting a few popes and rejecting all of them? I mean, it's
It's very simple, because these guys, according to the teaching of the popes, according to the teaching of the past popes, you must not accept someone like this as a legitimate pope. Pope Paul IV declared in his bull that the election of a heretic is invalid, and he can be treated as a warlock, a heathen, a publican, a heretic. Okay? That's the teaching of the Catholic Church. And so adhering to a guy who dresses up as if he's the Pope and denies all of Catholic teaching, that is not fidelity to the papacy. That is fidelity to an anti-
deny all of Catholic teaching.
He denies everything. He teaches that non-Catholics can be saved. He teaches that non-Catholics can receive Holy Communion. He teaches that the gospel is historically inaccurate. He teaches that Protestants don't need conversion. He denies Vatican I. He teaches that the Orthodox are in the Church. He esteems Islam. Okay. He praises other non-Christian religions. He takes active part in non-Christian worship. He's going to have another Assisi event, which is also apostasy by deed, is condemned in Mortali Animus. But you said that you had problems with the Society of St. Pius X position. But doctrinally, you're the same. Here's why. Because you dissent from the official teachings of Benedict XVI. Dominus Iesus is his official teaching.
Official. I mean, the thing is, if the Pope were to call me in, let's say, for example, he were to call me in and say, how come you don't give communion to heretics? You know, how come you don't give communion to non-Catholics? I could say, because your canon law gives me freedom not to.
No, that's not the issue.
It does. It gives me freedom not to, because if it says I may, it doesn't say I have to.
I would agree with that, but that's not the issue.
Freedom not to.
I would agree with you there, but that's...
I would never be... And in fact, I've been called on the carpet many, many times.
But here's...
And I've defended myself every single time on the basis of tradition.
But
And it's never been able to stick.
But here's...
They're not promoting doctrine. They're promoting confusion.
Here's the issue. It's not whether you personally give them communion. If he called you in and he said, well, your name's Father Gordon.
Yep.
Father, do you agree that others may lawfully give non-Catholics Holy Communion?
I would say no.
Well, then you're dissenting.
Because, and the fact that, you know, that you've stated it, and see, the thing is that I can dissent from that, because it says, they may. I said they shouldn't. You know, they can't.
Well, see, you're dissenting. You can't dissent from that, because that's the official teaching. Vatican II, the Code of Canon Law, the New Catechism,
right.
Encyclicals.
You could tell me this, and I would agree, because I've already been through a lot of these fights already with bishops, you know. And so, you know, I'll sit down and tell them, I said, no, I could say that, and I could fall back on all the popes that have always said that, you know. And the fact of the matter is, they won't go against my position on that.
Right. Well, because they...
can be in the Church and hold that position.
I'm
proof that you can be in the Church.
They allow anybody in the... quote church, unless you...
That's true.
Right.
That's true. But the thing is, if they allow me in the Church and I can hold the Church's position, but see, the one thing I can't get around is where the Pope is, there's a Church. And I know you don't buy that, but I do. In conscience, I buy that. And even if it's like, say, an erroneous conscience, and I've been looking into this, there's no position to hold and make me hold otherwise.
No, but here's the point. You're not addressing the issue of, is what is taught in Vatican II, the New Catechism, the New Code of Canon Law, encyclicals, that the official teaching of the Church or not. The Church can't teach error in all those areas. Okay? The ordinary and universal magisterium is infallible.
Okay, so then which canon law do you follow in 1917?
The 1917 Code of Canon Law is something that was promulgated for the Latin Church. Okay? But I don't accept the 1983 code of canon law.
No, but I'm just saying you follow the 1917 code then, right?
I acknowledge it insofar as it does not contradict something of greater weight.
So are you Eastern Rite or are you Set of Acontis?
I'm a Set of Acontis. I'm a Catholic, but the correct position is to hold that the chair is vacant. And this whole situation is predicted to arise as well.
Well, if you're holding that the seat is vacant, you know, then who's going to make the official judgment on that? See, I need magisterial. You know, now you're giving me arguments, and that's fine and everything like that. But you know, I do need an authority because myself, I'm not going to dissent. You know, from the authority. If there's a document that says if anything gives me leeway. Just like St. Thomas More, I think we're stuck in those types of times where we're just looking at this. What does the oath say?
So then you have to accept Nancy Pelosi as a Catholic.
I don't accept Nancy Pelosi. Your conclusions are wrong then. Because I can't. I don't accept it. And you say,
by what authority do you not accept her as a Catholic?
Because of what's always been taught by the Church.
Exactly. And the Church, same Church, teaches that you must reject as outside.
I don't say I must. I go.
Yes, it does.
If called me in and said, "Why didn't you give communion to Nancy Pelosi?" In fact, I would be if I did that out here. Archbishop Nauman, you know, my bishop here right now, he would pat me on the back for not giving her.
I'm not talking about giving communion right now. I'm talking about acknowledging her as a Catholic.
If I didn't acknowledge her as a Catholic, well, the thing is that I could say, well, she's a baptized Catholic. Is she formally, you know, you guys have they have to formally excommunicate her.
Not true. That's not Catholic teaching. The traditional teaching of the Church is that people who depart from the authoritative rule of the magisterium must be considered outside the Church.
Yeah, and they have to be, but the Church has to give them, the Church also has put as part of their procedures to tell the person, you are in this and this and this. You have, you know, just like they do with Martin Luther, you know, and of course he was excommunicated.
No, but
the very fact that he was given the chance.
But what you're saying is that there has to be an actual declaration for someone to consider another person as a heretic.
Not a declaration, but there has to be the person has to be in formal heresy. The person has to be the person coming out. The Church has to question that person, and they're not doing that.
Well, actually, no. Saint Robert Bellarmine points out that you can and must reject a manifest heretic as outside of communion before any examination or declaration. And that's also what Pope Paul IV teaches in his bull Cum Ex Apostolatus Fici. He says, before any declaration, this person is rejected. And the reason for that is that the unity of the Church is such that if it were not the case, let's say you have lax bishops or apostates who don't declare people, as we do today, people who claim to be bishops, and you have someone who rejects the divinity of Christ,
right.
According to your standard, you'd have to call him a Catholic until he was declared or warned. That's ridiculous.
And even the 1917 code talks about that.
No, it teaches that people lose their offices without any declaration. That's what it teaches, Canon 188.4. And it actually cites the bull I'm talking about, Pope Paul IV's bull Cum Ex Apostolatus Officio, which says, without any declaration, Catholics may reject these people.
Okay, so going back to Pope John the 22nd, Was he excommunicated?
No, because what he taught was an error on something that had not been dogmatically defined. It was not dogmatically defined.
Heresy. I mean, it doesn't matter. The Immaculate Conception was always understood by the Church as what was dogmatic. I mean, it was dogmatically defined, but because it had always been understood.
Heresy.
The thing is that everybody understood that on Pope John. Why did John the 22nd even come back and make and recant that before his death, you know, if he didn't know it was wrong.
In fact, if you read the Catholic Encyclopedia article on that issue, John the 23rd, said that he was not making any definitive pronouncement on the issue and that he was willing to correct himself. And furthermore, it's not heresy because Let me just finish.
It is contrary to
No, it's not heresy because heresy is a denial of an article of divine and Catholic faith, something that has been magisterially taught by the Church. That was not dogmatically defined until the next pope in Benedictus Deus, 1336, Pope Benedict XIII.
Well, Arianism, then, is any pope
the 12th.
Believed in Arianism until that was condemned?
Say that again?
So any pope can believe in Arianism until that was condemned?
No, here's the difference. Because there are certain mysteries of faith, as I was saying earlier, with regard to material heresy, that must be known and believed by all, such as that there's one true God, that Christ is God and man. They're called the essential mysteries. There are other deeper dogmas, such as whether the elect received the beatific vision, As soon as they die and are purged, or at the end of the world, that's a deeper issue, which you wouldn't be a heretic until you've seen a dogmatic definition and contradict it. But with the basic truths that there's one God, that there's a Trinity, that Christ is God and man, there's no excuse. Like someone who believes that there are four gods, that person is not a material heretic. That person is just a heretic, because that person does not know what he must know and believe. And that's what Pius X and Benedict XIV taught, that there are certain mysteries of faith which you must know.
Absolutely, not that clearly would say a person is not Catholic.
And that's why Benedict XVI cannot be a material heretic, because he denies things that every Catholic must know, such as that there's one true religion.
But he will say, if you ask him flat out, if you confront him, is there one true religion, he'll tell you yes.
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah, but he will.
But first of all,
if you look at the forums that he's stating these other things, you know, he's being political and totally imprudent. I believe that. But the thing is that he's not going to go against that. If you corner him and you ask him the question, he's not going to go against that.
Well, he is actually, and furthermore, like let's say John Kerry has claimed that he's personally opposed to abortion, but that he doesn't impose his view on others. So someone can claim to believe in something, but if they contradict it many other times, it doesn't matter. That's why Pope Pius VI said in Auctorum Fidei, a constitution, he said that heretics always contradict themselves. And so if they teach heresies, it doesn't matter if they state the truth some other times. And so even if Benedict XVI did say there was one true religion, and I bet you if he were questioned, he wouldn't. He would give some convoluted heretical answer. But it doesn't matter, because he says things that deny that, namely, he esteems false religions. And in fact, in his book Truth and Tolerance, there are quotes where he clearly contradicts the truth that there's one true religion.
Well, can I ask you this? Where do you go for confessions?
To a priest ordained in the traditional rite.
But does he have faculties from a bishop? And I guess you're going to go back to you.
The church supplies jurisdiction.
But it can't supply for validity, though.
Yeah, it can.
No, it can. It could supply, but the church is not supplying for jurisdiction in these cases.
No, the church does supply jurisdiction. And, in fact, that's the traditional teaching of the church and the authorities who have addressed that.
But it supplies in what sense? I mean, if it can't supply for these are sacraments that receive the. I mean, like say for example, a priest who's been, it'll supply in certain circumstances in cases of emergency where you have a guy who's dying and you have a priest who's been, he's been defrocked, he's suspended. And you can actually hear confessions because you're talking about a situation where a person's in danger of death. You know, and in that case, the church will supply. In common error, the church can supply. But the thing is that it can't supply for validity, you know, and that's one of the situations that I think you'll find yourself in and also the society is in, you know, and those are things I can't get around.
Well, that's actually not true. The church does supply, it supplies in doubt of law, probable doubt of fact, supplies in common error. And in fact, in the first millennium of the church, a distinction was not even made between validity and jurisdiction.
But it is now, though. It's been clarified. Just like you mentioned about the dogma before John the 22nd, it wasn't stated before and then it's stated afterwards. Well, it's clearly stated now.
Right, but we're talking about a principle that operates that, I agree, church couldn't supply if you have someone who has not been ordained in a traditional rite of the church.
But see, there's two sacraments that require both ordination and they require order and jurisdiction. They require both. And the two sacraments are confession and matrimony. Both have to be fulfilled, you know. And the other ones are just exceptions. They're not.
Well, what I'm saying is you don't have jurisdiction.
I do.
No, you don't. You don't have it from a Catholic bishop. Who?
Archbishop Nelman.
That's a guy who believes that non-Catholics can be saved.
He's connected with the Pope. I mean,
he's not connected with the Pope.
There's no problems in the Church. I'm just saying that, you know, there has to be a visible head and there's visible members. That's the visibility of the Church.
No, it actually.
That's one of the four marks of the Church. It has to be visible.
No. Well, here's the thing. Nelman accepts Vatican II, and Vatican II teaches that the Church is not visible. Here's what your Church teaches. John Paul II.
But you believe it, though.
I believe what?
It's visible.
I know the church is visible. What I'm saying to you is your church is not visible. Here's why.
Well, your church isn't visible because you're talking about the remnant of people. That's like
I'll give you the proof for what I'm saying. John Paul II, Ut Unum Sint, number 7, what Melman would accept. And yet almost everyone, though in different ways, longs that there may be one visible church of God, a church truly universal. Okay, so according to Melman...
We all want it.
No, it exists. We don't long for it. It's here. Okay? Your church...
They're saying they long for it. That's what's wrong.
Right, meaning it doesn't exist yet.
You just said that's what they wrote.
That's what John Paul II taught. That's your church.
Yeah, we all long for one true universal church.
But if one exists already, we don't long for it. It's already here. It's one of the marks of the church.
Well, we long that all men be members of this church.
No, that's not what he's saying.
Yeah, but the thing is that but you can understand that that's what can be understood from it.
That's not what he means. Here's another quote on the same topic.
Right.
Here's another quote. Homily, December 5th, 1996, speaking of non-Catholics, when we pray together, we do so with the longing that there may be one visible church of God, a church truly universal. Okay? So according to Melman, there is no visible church yet because you're still longing for unity with heretics. And actually, according to Melman, where Peter is not, there is the church. Where the Orthodox are, there is the church. He's in communion with the Orthodox. And so you have the robes, but you don't have the faith.
I've got the faith.
And you also dissent from what your church teaches, as I pointed out, with non-Catholics receiving Holy Communion lawfully.
Because the thing is, you're elevating to doctrine, to church doctrine, what isn't doctrine. And you're elevating to dogma what isn't dogma. And that's why you hold your position. You know, I mean, we're in very, very confusing times, and I realize that right now. You know, the thing is that there's certain dogmas that I can't get around.
So basically, Benedict XVI is wrong about what he considers binding church teaching.
Well, what the church teaching has always been taught, what's always been taught, is what we always have to believe. His job, the job of every pope, is to pass on what's been given to him, so he passes it on to the next generation. You know, and that's, you know, that's one of the problems right now, is it's not being passed on. You know, and it's being convoluted and confused. He's not. I'm going to say he's a pope. You know,
no, but is he wrong when he says that Vatican II's and Dominus Iesus's teaching that the Orthodox are in the church is binding?
And that's in that document that you just stated. But the document that he's stating it in is not a binding document.
But is he wrong?
In that, you could say yes.
Okay, so
it's not a binding document.
No, the documents he's referring to would be binding. And so that just proves my point, that you dissent, your own, quote, pope, the one you think is Peter, you dissent from what he says is binding.
There's no doubt. Well, there's no doubt in my mind he's the pope.
No, I can tell you infallibly he's not the pope. Infallibly.
Infallibly he is.
No, well, I'm telling you, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong.
I know, but that's...
And you're also wrong about jurisdiction, because the church, you don't understand supply jurisdiction.
I mean, I've
do you want to debate me on it?
Look, I've got to save souls, and I know you've got your agenda and your thing like that, you know. But I'm not going to get into this argument. I mean, I really don't have the time right now. You know, I'm pretty busy.
Let me ask you this: do you believe non-Catholics can be saved?
I don't believe non-Catholics can be saved. I believe that you have to be a member of the Catholic Church to be saved.
So. Are you aware that Archbishop Lefebvre taught in his book that souls can be saved in a religion other than the Catholic religion?
I don't follow Archbishop Lefebvre.
I know. I'm just saying, was that heretical when he said that?
When he said that the Catholics can be saved outside the church?
When he said souls can be saved in a religion other than the Catholic religion?
No, I don't believe that.
But is that heretical?
I would say, yeah, you can't believe that anybody can be saved. They can be saved by the merits of the Catholic Church, like, say, considering situations of baptism, the desire and baptism of blood. Those are only given in death and in rare circumstances.
So you do believe that non-Catholics could be saved, quote, by the merits of the Church, even though they don't have the faith?
Only by the merits of the Church.
So you do believe non-Catholics can be saved?
No, I don't believe that. Do you believe in baptism, the desire and baptism of
blood? No.
You don't? Okay, well,
I'm very familiar with the issue.
Well, right. So then that's the thing, and the church has always taught that.
It hasn't always taught that.
Yeah, St. Thomas Aquinas
did teach that. He also taught that Mary was not immaculate. Okay.
Yeah, I know, but the thing is, though, is but he didn't teach her that she was an immaculate. What he said, he was going back. He had actually a medical error on that. You know, he thought, because according to him, he thought that conception of the, he says, when the human soul was infused, that's when Our Lady was immaculate conceived. But he understood as conception being kind of like a plant growing in a garden where the seed is dropped, and the seed is dropped in the womb, and then of course it begins as plant life. Then the soul is quickened and it becomes becomes animal life, and then the soul is quickened and it becomes a human life. But at the moment that the human soul was there, he said that that's what Our Lady was conceived at that moment. So he never denied the immaculate conception. He only had it medically wrong because he didn't have the biological knowledge that we have now. But if you were to tell him, if you were to ask him today what he was teaching in that thing, he says, when the human soul was infused in our Blessed Mother's, when she was immaculately conceived. So he never denied the Immaculate Conception.
Well, he did, actually. I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
No, he never denied it.
I have the quotes for you. I could give them to you.
I've read it already. I've had to quote it to a few Feeneyites. You know?
Did you know that, so you would agree that idea, the Aristotelian idea of when the soul was infused, that he held, you would agree that's erroneous?
When he says that I would say at the moment, but what he said at the time that the soul, that the human soul was there, as soon as, at the very beginning of the human soul, is Our Lady was conceived immaculate.
But do you agree that that's an erroneous view of conception?
If on the biological level and on the physical level, yes.
And how about on the theological level? That the human
theological level, absolutely not. I mean, if when the soul is infused, which is at the moment of conception, when the soul is infused, that is when Our Lady was immaculate.
But is it erroneous in your view to hold that the human body grows and begins to exist, and then sometime later, maybe a few weeks later, the soul is infused?
No, the human soul is infused at the moment of conception. That's the biological fact.
So you would agree that it's erroneous to hold that the human body begins to grow and then the soul may be infused a few weeks later?
I don't believe that.
So therefore you would agree that that's theologically erroneous?
It's not theological, it's a biological. Right now you're talking about both metaphysically and physically.
No, but it also deals with theological issues.
Well, yes, it touches on it. But the thing is that he never denied the theological part of it. That's the point. He never denied the theological.
No, I'm not talking about him right now. I'm talking about.
But that's what I was talking about. But I'm talking about that very. Impression.
No, but I'm trying to understand your position. That is your position that it's theologically erroneous to hold that the human body begins to grow, that it's the matter is infused, and then the soul is infused maybe a few weeks later.
I'm not talking theologically, I'm talking biologically.
Yeah, I'm asking you theologically.
No,
well, if it's wrong biologically, it's wrong theologically, because...
Well, the thing is, but I'm going back to St. Thomas, because that's the point that we're trying to correct here, is that's what we're looking at, and that's why we're making this distinction right now, is because we're talking about St. Thomas. And St. Thomas had, biologically, he didn't understand what was going on at that point, but the very fact that he said when the human soul was infused, that's what we're looking at. When the human soul was infused, it was immaculately conceived. So if he had it if he understood biologically what was going on and metaphysically what was going on at that point, he would have clearly said that the Immaculate Conception, yes, he believed in entirely the Immaculate Conception.
Now, he held that her soul was stained with original sin for a certain period of time. That's just a fact.
But not when the human soul was infused, though. That's what he said.
What he said was not consistent with what was later promulgated. He had a convoluted view of conception when it's compared to what has been later dogmatically defined, and his position was wrong. And in fact,
okay, so St. Thomas, we can just take the Summa and chuck that.
I didn't say that.
Well, what relevance does that have? You're trying to say that St. Thomas was wrong on that point. Therefore, he can be wrong on every other point.
My point was, you cited St. Thomas to prove that baptism of desire is a teaching of the Church, and my point is that he's not infallible. Okay,
You're right, which means that all his writings can be questioned.
All his writings would have to be subjected to the higher authority of the Church. In other words, they are to be given respect, and I read St. Thomas a lot, but if we're confronted with something of greater weight that contradicts him, and in fact, St. Thomas himself says that we must discard the opinion of a doctor when we are confronted with the judgment of the church. And so adhering to St. Thomas actually requires us to go with the teaching of the church and not with what he said. But the fact is, the church is not always...
St. Alphonsus also.
St. Alphonsus was an incredible writer, but he wasn't infallible.
But the church says you can even trust the opinion. The magisterial teaching of the church talks about St. Alphonsus. You can trust an opinion, and you cannot, and you will not err.
It's talking about his moral theological opinions are safe. The church also says St. Gregory Nazianzen in the breviary, that there's nothing in his writings which any reasonable person could call into question. Yet he denied baptism of desire.
Okay, so we can't. But the thing is that St. Alphonsus was the one that's very. I mean, he's very, very clear on his position. St. Thomas is clear on his.
St. Gregory Nazianzen.
I'd have to read St. Gregory Nazianzen on that one. But the thing is that you'd have to have if the unanimous understandings of the doctors. Is how you have to take it, because whenever you have a unanimous quote on the church fathers or the church doctors, you can consider it infallible.
Not unanimous. That's the point. The church fathers are not unanimous. That's a myth that's promulgated in Society of St. Pius X circles and Fraternity of St. Peter circles, that the fathers of the church were unanimous in favor of, quote, baptism of desire. It's not true. In fact, the majority of the fathers of the church rejected the idea.
I would like to see not at all because Saint Ambrose and Saint Augustine actually promoted it, because Saint Augustine wrote a letter to Saint Ambrose about Valentinian, the emperor, he was one of the governors in the Roman Empire. He was on his way to receive baptism and he was killed by robbers. And Saint Augustine writes a letter to Saint Ambrose lamenting his death. Saint Ambrose says, "No, absolutely not. His desire for the very sacrament was his reception."
He says, "Did he not get what he desired?" His letter is ambiguous. In fact, I've written on the topic.
Yeah, but see, then the thing is, you can clearly see though he was telling Saint Augustine what he was actually telling him about baptism of desire. So here you have another doctor and father of the church, two doctors and fathers of the church, writing each other on this.
You also have Saint Ambrose saying that no man goes to heaven without the sacrament of baptism. And he didn't say that. Hold on a sec. He didn't say that Valentinian was saved without baptism. He didn't say that anywhere. He said.
He says, but his desire for the sacrament was the reception of it. So, of course, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the quote in front of me.
Right in that very text, he says that not even martyrs are crowned if they're catechumens.
Well, what about Saint Emerentiana? She was a catechumen and she was a martyr, and she was at the grave site there of Saint Agnes, her cousin, and she'd just been killed. Saint Emerentiana was a catechumen at the time, and she was killed. That's in the breviary as well. So Saint Emerentiana was a canonized saint who was never baptized by water.
Well, first of all, the term catechumen doesn't necessarily mean unbaptized, because hold on a sec. Saint Ambrose said that his catechumens still underwent instruction after their baptisms. And so it doesn't say anywhere that she was unbaptized. And in fact, the breviary is not infallible in all of its entries. And that's admitted by not only countless authors, but it's the Roman martyrology, etc., have been revised by numerous popes. I mean, there are all kinds of papal teachings on corrections.
Well, before we go any further, let's just, I'll just make an analysis of who we've blown out of the water, of who we can't trust anymore.
I didn't say we can't trust.
No, but I want to be honest about this, We can't quote, St. Thomas because he's questionable. I can't quote St. Alphonsus, he's questionable. I can't quote St. Augustine, I can't quote St. Ambrose, they're all questionable. I can't quote any...
Can I respond to that?
I can't quote Denzinger because Denzinger believes in baptism.
Denzinger is a collection
really
of documents.
Any teaching of the church. I mean, I'm left with very, very.
Sir, let me respond to that.
Let me just follow you, Brother Peter. I think you've got the truth.
Hold on a
second. You're the only one that's right.
No, what I'm saying to you is that Saint Ambrose contradicts you. He teaches that no man is saved without water baptism. So does Saint Alphonse, Saint Augustine.
Absolutely.
So does Saint Augustine.
But they say certain circumstances.
And that's why we go by what the church has taught. And the church has dogmatically defined that if anyone shall say that the sacrament of baptism. As referring to the sacrament, if anyone shall say that baptism is not necessary for salvation, let him be anathema.
Absolutely, and I absolutely agree with that.
You don't.
The thing is that baptism of blood and baptism of desire are part of baptism. They're not of water, but they're baptism.
Are they the sacrament of baptism?
They are not the sacrament of baptism.
Right.
But they work sacramentally, but there's no indelible mark left on the soul.
Right, it's not a sacrament.
Those things entitled them. What about the, you had 40 Roman soldiers who were out on the lake, you know, and one of them apostatized, and then one of the Roman soldiers who was not a Catholic and who was not baptized, he dropped his spear, went on the frozen lake, and died with all of them, and he's considered those 40 saints, and he's one of them, and he wasn't baptized.
The church has never said they weren't baptized, and in fact, one of them, according to the martyrology, let me answer. Okay, the church has never said they weren't baptized, and one of them, according to the martyrology, cried out in a loud voice that he was a Christian because he was already baptized. That's why.
And he didn't say I'm a Christian.
Yeah, he did. In fact, I have the quote here. In fact, we've addressed these objections. This is the Roman Martyrology, September 9th. At Sebastian, Armenia, St. Severian, for frequently visiting the 40 martyrs. So it shows, actually, this entry shows that the martyrs were visited by saints, so they could have been instructed and baptized.
They could have.
And then it goes on to say that one of them cried out with a loud voice that he was a Christian because he was baptized. And see, here's the point, that there's nothing, all the stuff you're bringing up can be addressed and answered and refuted. But what I'm quoting...
But your points can be just...
No, here's the point. Are the catechumens part, are unbaptized catechumens part of the faithful?
Unbaptized catechumens part of the faithful, no.
Okay. Well, it's dogmatically defined, Pope Innocent III, that there's one universal church of the faithful, outside of which nobody at all is saved.
Okay.
So,
does that include catechumens then, unbaptized catechumens?
You just admitted they're not part of the faithful.
Well, you just said they are.
No, I didn't. I said a catechumen
could
be.
You just said that they are, though. An unbaptized catechumen.
No, I said they're not part of the faithful.
Well, then, but that's what I'm saying. St. Emerenciana.
No, sir.
And she's not part of the faithful.
So you admit that unbaptized catechumens are not part of the faithful. You already admitted that, right?
Unbaptized catechumens are not part of
it. Right, and it's dogmatically defined that there's no salvation for anyone who's not part of the faithful.
Okay. Well, if you hold on, I got an appointment right now, brother, so...
Well, listen, I would check out our website, VaticanCatholic.com.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I would strongly suggest, Brother Peter, I know your ideas are very, very strong, and I know this is a confusing time, but I'll be praying for you, you know.
Well, I would tell you in charity that you won't save your soul in your present positions.
I know. Well, I will tell you in charity as well that you will not save your soul in your present
positions. You're in communion with a guy who rejects the whole papacy.
Well, I'm not going to go any further on this, but you've got your position, I've got mine, and I'm in truly good conscience, and I have no qualm of conscience.
No. And you would dissent from what Benedict XVI officially says.
No, I won't.
So what he's wrong, what he says is binding.
I'm sorry, but I got to go.
Okay. All right.
All right. Bye-bye.